This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. Easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Hello, I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and I want to wish a happy birthday to the man who named the United States of America, without whom our country probably would not exist, the revolutionary and deist Thomas Paine, a person who used to be lauded in the 19th century by freethinkers every January 29th. His birthday would be celebrated. They would get together and have dinner parties, freethinkers, and celebrate Thomas Paine, who wrote the classic repudiation of the Bible and revealed religion, The Age of Reason.
I'm Dan Barker. So are we in the Age of Reason yet?
Not really.
No, well, when you hear some of the news we have to report today, you might wonder. I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist of the airwaves, and today is January the 25th, 2014. We are broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin, and we podcast around the world, and then we also broadcast later in the weekend and later in the week in other states, such as California, New York, in Michigan, Missouri, and you might be listening to us in Central Texas.
Free Thought Radio's the weekly production of FFRF, which stands for Freedom From Religion Foundation, and we were begun nationally in 1978. My mother and I started the group as a regional group in Madison, Wisconsin in 1976, and were asked to go national with it in 78, and we've gone from our original two and then three members to almost, well, we're at 20,000, but we still need you to join us to keep at that number. And we are an association of freethinkers, atheists and agnostics, and we work to keep religion out of government and to defend the constitutional principle of the separation between church and state.
Today, we're going to talk about the mind of the Bible believer. Valerie Tirico is a psychologist. She ran the Children's Behavior and Learning Clinic in Bellevue, Washington. She is a former evangelical Christian. She's a graduate of Wheaton College, Billy Graham's college. She's written the book called Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light.
And you should be able to talk the same language, Dan, since you were also one of those true believer evangelical Christians. Do evangelical Christians really believe all that stuff, or were you just pretending?
Well, let's talk about that during the second half of today's show when we interview Valerie Tirico.
And on the first segment, we will have a little bit of a musical interlude that'll be enjoyable in the next part of Free Thought Radio, but we want to comment on a lot of news in the past week, mostly assaults on the separation between church and state. And first, I want to laud and bring attention to an excellent column last week by Frank Bruni, who writes a regular column for the New York Times. It was called The Cruelest Pregnancy, and he brings attention to a terrible case going on in Texas. You may have followed that in late November, a woman named Marlies Munoz, who is 33, was found unconscious on the kitchen floor by her husband, whose name is Eric. She apparently had suffered a pulmonary embolism, and at the hospital, it was determined she was brain dead. So her husband naturally requested that she be discontinued from the machines that were keeping her vital organs functioning, and they had been paramedics, and he knew well what her views were on this kind of support. And they had discussed end-of-life decisions, but she didn't have a living will. But he told the hospital he knew she wouldn't want any extraordinary measures taken. And he loved her very much, but it was time to say goodbye. So guess what happened? The hospital officials wouldn't let him make this decision. they went ahead with extraordinary measures because Marlise had been 14 weeks pregnant at the time. And even though abortion is legal in that window, there's a Texas law that compels hospitals to provide life support for terminally ill patients with fetuses developing inside them. And of course, she's not terminal. She's brain dead. So her family, her parents, terribly distressed about it. Two prominent obstetricians told Frank Bruni that when you have a case like this, the neurological damage to the fetus could be irreparable, already suffered because of the maternal embolism, oxygen deprivation, that the artificial organ maintenance can entail an array of dangers to the fetus, including major infections. And so the hospital is executing the will of the state. They're making all of the calls about the care of the fetus, which is now 21 weeks along. But it's the family that will inherit all of the problems and all of the grief. And it really is a terrible situation. And that's why Frank Bruni called his column The Cruelest Pregnancy. And she meets the legal criteria for death in all 50 states, but her corpse has been tethered to a machine, and she's basically an incubator for a fetus that has been given precedence over all other concerns.
For religious reasons.
For religious reasons,
the state law is based on really Christian fundamentalist and Catholic doctrine.
A very sobering situation. Now, closer to home here in the state of Wisconsin, we have sort of an outrageous situation where we have vouchers, and Wisconsin was the first state to really get vouchers. Unfortunately, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, in an ACLU case, ruled that our protections in the state Supreme Court were dead on separation of church and state. And there is a huge voucher expansion. And here's one of many scandals that has beset this 24-year program. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this week reported that a husband and wife running a private Milwaukee voucher school that abruptly closed last month had accepted more than $2.3 million in taxpayers' money. They disappeared from Wisconsin. Now they are living in a gated community in Florida by the beach in a big home. And they are starting another Christian school getting public funding in Florida. And their K through 8 voucher school in Milwaukee was called Life Skills Academy. It served only about 400 low-income students since joining the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program in 2008 and 2009. $2.3 million in taxpayer money for that. It closed around December 13th, forcing 66 students to find other schools without notice. And get this, only one child in Wisconsin, in their school in Wisconsin, met the state benchmark for reading. No students could read or do math proficiently in 2011 or 2012, according to state test scores. Just before closing, the school had collected another $200,000 in taxpayer money for this academic year. And so this is, they get a subsidy of up to $6,442 per child for voucher schools.
I bet those kids could read the word scam, S-C-A-M.
Well, and already 26,000, almost 26,000 children in Milwaukee are participating in the program. And then, of course, it's been expanded to some other schools around the state. Now they've gone to Milwaukee, where they live in this gated community, and they have opened up with public money another school where apparently there are only 8 or 9 children enrolled, including some or all of their own children. Their names are Taryn and Rodney Monroe, and there's a lot of concerns about even their house originally was owned in Milwaukee by a religious group they were affiliated with, and then they gave the house to the husband. The whole thing is just reeks from beginning to end. And now they've got this fancy gated community house and all this, you know, getting rich on voucher money. And look how the kids are being educated. Just one example. And in the middle of all of this scandal, several legislators have reintroduced into Wisconsin, this Wisconsin legislature, an attempt to get even more money for kids with disabilities so they could go to voucher schools. And all of the major disability groups oppose this because private schools would be exempted from federal requirements on disabilities. And so we are watching this very carefully, very distressing. And you've got even more distressing news on another front.
Well, in other news, a document released last week shows that Pope Benedict, the previous pope, defrocked nearly 400 priests over 2 years for sexually molesting children. This is child rape. The statistics for 2011 and 2012 show a dramatic increase over the 171 priests who were removed in 2008-2009. That's when the Vatican first provided details on the number of priests who have been defrocked. This document, obtained by the Associated Press last Friday, was prepared from data the Vatican had been collecting to help it defend itself before a United Nations committee last week in Geneva. An Associated Press review of the annual reports shows a big change in the Vatican's procedures to discipline pedophiles since 2001. That's when the Vatican first ordered bishops to send cases of all credibly accused priests to Rome for review. But the bishops were routinely moving problem priests from parish to parish rather than defrocking them or turning them into the police. The maximum penalty for a priest convicted by a church tribunal is, get this, the maximum penalty is losing their job, being defrocked. There's no jail terms, and there's nothing to prevent an offending priest from raping again. In the year 2010, there was an explosion of thousands of cases reported in the media across Europe. Some 527 cases were reported to the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. And you know what that actually is, right?
The Inquisition.
Yeah, it used to be called the Inquisition.
And it used to be run by Cardinal Ratzinger, who did become Pope Benedict. So, well, and then closer to home.
Closer to home. Well, out of Chicago, the news this week out of Chicago, priest sex abuse files from the Archdiocese of Chicago go public. One of the largest dioceses in the United States handed over more than 6,000 pages of documents to victims' attorneys who said they will show that the Archdiocese concealed abuse for decades, including moving priests to new parishes where they molested again. This is an old story. You wrote about this in your book back in the 80s.
FFRF published, and I wrote the first book about clergy abuse of children back in 1988.
So nothing's changed.
Out of print, but you can read it online. No, nothing has changed except there. Well, we get these flurries of news reports and some movement, but then we go back to the same thing, and the church keeps insisting, oh, these are old cases. Well, 400 priests defrocked recently.
That they admit, right, mm-hmm. that we even know about. Out of Chicago, the disclosures involved 30 priests. These disclosures were made as part of a legal settlement with the abuse victims, showing exactly how the Roman Catholic Church shielded their priests and failed for many years to report child sex abuse to the authorities. And they claim that they are the moral standard in the world. Cardinal Francis George, who has led the Chicago Archdiocese since 1997, released a letter to parishioners on January the 12th, in which he apologized for the abuse and said that now releasing these records, quote, raises transparency to a new level.
Yeah, and believe me, his name is all over the news, has been ever since and before he was cardinal there, because, you know, these go back so far. So, yeah, where's that? What good is that apology?
Well, he says it's raising transparency to a new level. Well, why wasn't it at the highest level all along? Why did it have to be forced by legal action?
Transparency was at the incredibly lowest level.
So now it's up to level one, maybe, or level two, right? He also claimed that much of the abuse occurred decades ago before he became the archbishop. So
they didn't know anything.
Yeah. The archdiocese has paid millions of dollars to settle sexual abuse claims, including those against Father Daniel McCormack, who was sentenced to 5 years in prison after pleading guilty in 2007 to abusing five children while he was a parish priest at St. Agatha Catholic Church, and he was a teacher at a Catholic school. The next year, the archdiocese agreed to pay $12.6 million to 16 victims of sexual abuse by priests, including by McCormack. Peter Isley, who's the Midwest director for the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, said, "It's important for all Chicago area Catholics to read those documents. This is about a part of their story as Chicago Catholics," he said, "that has been systematically hidden."
So we are working, actually, we have an amicus brief with SNAP, Survivors Network.
Those abused by priests?
Yeah, and many other groups that work against child abuse, such as CHILD. Children's Healthcare is a legal duty against the against Hobby Lobby and supporting the government's position in this case that will be heard by the Supreme Court in March. And we worked with Marcy Hamilton on that, and that was being filed next week. So if you want to keep track of black collar crimes, we have one every month, a column in Free Thought Today.
Stay tuned. We're going to be talking with Valerie Tirico about her new book, Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is Free Thought Radio.
Oh, but you're lovely, with your smile so warm, and your cheeks so soft, there is nothing for me but to love you, just the way you look tonight.
And we're back with Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and I'm not complaining, but why are we listening to Fred Astaire singing The Way You Look Tonight?
The Way You Look Tonight was a song which won the 1936 Academy Award for the Best Song. And that song was written by a non-believer. This week is the birthday of the songwriter Jerome Kern. He was born January the 27th in 1885. Jerome Kern, as we've talked about on this show before, Jerome Kern was called the father of the American musical theater. Jerome Kern was thoroughly non-religious. His Jewish parents, after they were married in a temple, completely abandoned their religion. They taught none of the religion to their son. And Jerome Kern grew up to have the motto, which wasn't religious, life is to be enjoyed.
And he certainly made it more enjoyable for many people. The Way You Look Tonight's still a popular standard, played at many weddings. And this is just a tiny sampling of the many songs written by Jerome Kern.
This is a fine romance.
It's a fine romance with no kisses. A fine romance, my friend. This is
what you should. I know that moment divine when all the things you I gotta love one man till I die. Can't help loving that man of mine. When your heart's on fire, you must realize smoke gets in your eyes.
He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along.
And those were some of the songs written by Jerome Kern, a very prolific, non-believing songwriter. We heard Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. Sarah Vaughan sang All the Things You Are. Lena Horne, Can't Help Loving That Man of Mine. Dinah Washington sang a bit of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. And then, of course, Paul Robeson sang Old Man River.
And Paul Robeson was a good freethinker, by the way. And another good freethinker has a birthday today, an anniversary of her birth date, January 25th, and that is Virginia Woolf, born in 1882, the novelist. And she once said, "I read the book of Job last night. I don't think God comes very well out of it."
Actually, I read the book of Job recently this month, and I agree. God comes off as a
Well, yeah.
As a moral monster, actually, what he did to that man. And this fits in with our segment coming up with our interview with Valerie Tirico. Valerie Tirico is a former fundamentalist evangelical who says the same thing. She's a graduate of Wheaton College, and she now is a free thinker. And her book is called Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. Here's a little bit of Jerome Kern. Stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
Life is good. Life is good. Life is unbelievably good. The superstitious monkey is off in my back. I'm thinking for myself and I am back on track. And I can tell you, life is good.
The superstitious monkey is off my back. I'm thinking for myself and I am back on track. And I can tell you, life is good. This is Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
And Dan, you're a former evangelical preacher, by the way.
That's right.
And I am Annie Laurie Gaylor, and I was raised without religion. So I didn't have to get the superstitious monkey off my back. But we're going to talk about how to do that and why to do that.
Our guest today is Valerie Tirico. And Valerie and I can talk the same language. And you can try to listen in, Annie Laurie. See if you can get any of us evangelical talk. Dr. Valerie Tirico, PhD, is a former fundamentalist Christian. She graduated from Wheaton College. That's Billy Graham's college.
That's in the Chicago area.
In Illinois. That's a bastion of evangelical education. She holds a doctorate in counseling psychology from the University of Iowa, and she's done some postdoctorate work at the University of Washington. She's in Seattle now. She's the former director of Children's Behavior and Learning Clinic in Bellevue, Washington. Dr. Tirico writes for the Huffington Post, for Salon.com. An article last year she wrote about the Internet's effect on religion. She writes for XChristian.net, and she hosts a TV series in Seattle, Washington, on moral politics. She promotes interfaith dialogue and the shared values which link all humanity. Her book, which we have here in the studio with us, is called Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light. It was published in 2010. It tells the story of her own deconversion and then explains what's wrong with Christian fundamentalism.
So, Valerie, nice to talk with you. Welcome to Free Thought Radio.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on the air with you today.
So, how did a graduate of Wheaton College get to where you are today?
Well, you know, I would say that even from high school onward, I was raised in an evangelical Christian family. My home church, Scottsdale Bible, is now an evangelical megachurch. But from high school onward, I was struggling with what I would describe as the moral and rational contradictions in Christianity. Chief among those was the thought that I couldn't even in high school get how I was going to be blissfully happy in heaven, perfectly happy with Jesus, while my best friend Kay, who was Mormon, was being tortured in hell, and it just wasn't going to matter to me.
Well, God would erase your memories or something, you know.
But isn't that twisted, right?
Yeah.
The thought of a God that has to make you unaware of something horrible.
Yeah, exactly.
In order to kind of have his plan play out, so that we have to be ignorant in order for our Christianity to work.
Well, at least you have a conscience about it. You know, Muslims will say they're going to sit up on their couches and laugh at us infidels as we burn in hell forever. They're going to enjoy it, which is, I think, different from most fundamentalists. You write in your book that when you went to Wheaton College, ironically, Wheaton College is really extremely fundamentalist, but that compared to your family upbringing, it was actually a little bit more open than your own fundamentalist beliefs.
Well, you know, now here comes that insider talk, Dan. You know, there were like premillennialists and postmillennialists at Wheaton College. There were people who thought that Jesus was going to, you know, reign for 1,000 years on earth, and the rapture was going to happen before that, and some thought the rapture was going to happen after that. And those things, I had been raised to believe there was only one right answer to those kind of questions.
And that's the danger of the fundamentalist mindset. It's absolutistic. It's like a binary, you know, when Jesus said in Revelation, you should be cold or hot, because if you're lukewarm, I'll spit you out of my mouth. That attitude that there can only be one right way.
Exactly.
So, Valerie, what did you major in at Wheaton?
Don't laugh. I majored in Spanish Latin American studies. And so I have to say that was an epiphany for me in terms of my politics, which were also incredibly right-wing at that point. My mom was a John Bircher. Being forced to study Latin American politics, I suddenly realized that we had done some horrible things south of our border, and that there were big, powerful corporations, the Dole Corporation, for example, that had basically used the American Army as a private set of mercenaries to enforce and ensure their profit margin, some things that had never, ever crossed my consciousness before. So my major didn't really affect my faith. It was more being in this context of Christianity, where it was okay to kind of question something like, did the rapture happen before or after the thousand-year reign of Christ on earth? And then, as I said, my sense that there were just things that were morally troubling, and that combination just kind of kept me evolving until it developed a more and more idiosyncratic form of faith. And then, I have to say I'm a kind of slow study in some ways, because it wasn't actually until clear after graduate school and I was out in Seattle doing a postdoctoral training at Children's Hospital that I finally hit the straw that broke the camel's back.
Did you come in contact with liberation theology then in Latin America?
I did come in contact with liberation theology and the notion of the church being on the side of the poor and elevating that what is called a prophetic voice in Scripture, the voice of social justice. It's actually kind of nice to see that coming back around in the Catholic hierarchy at this point with the new Pope, despite the fact that, of course, there's so many other ways in which the theology remains broken and flawed, and sitting as I do, as a woman looking at the church, it's clear that there are some places where there's absolutely no progress being made.
Well, no, before we move on to the straw that broke the camel's back, you confess in your book that you once wrote a paper attacking evolution.
How embarrassing.
Was that in high school?
Thank goodness I can plead that I was only in high school,
yeah.
And I was just repeating, you know, the creationist nonsense that had been handed to me.
And then you got kind of sucked into the late great planet Earth, end of the world stuff?
Yes.
And then the I Found It campaign, was that something that you were encouraged to, as a high schooler, to promote?
Oh, to be on the phone making cold calls to people in their homes to read the four spiritual laws to them. Again, I look at that and I just kind of cringe.
Young people listening to this might not remember. They'd be blissfully unaware of the I Found It campaign.
Big billboards all over the highway.
You want to explain it?
Yeah, those big billboards that said, I found it, and they were supposed to be a tantalizing tease. What did people find? What did people find? And then, you know, they arranged these huge phone banks in cities all over the country to call and tell strangers, have Christians call and tell strangers that what they'd found was the saving grace of Jesus. And, you know, the four spiritual laws involve recognizing that you're a sinner and that you can only be saved by the blood of Jesus, and then praying to accept Jesus into your heart.
And then one more thing you write about, which is actually something that FFRF has come up in some of our litigation, Bill Gothard and the discipleship. And is that an Illinois-based ministry, or how did you get involved with that?
Well, again, the Bill Gothard seminars were making the country. They taught a very strict kind of gender hierarchy, for example, and this kind of blood atonement Christianity with forced confession, almost the kind of confession that you hear about in more smaller countercultural cults, where people are forced to confess their sins to each other it's this shaming process. It's this sense that you are, as Mark Driscoll here in Seattle says, the Calvinist mega preacher says, you know, we're all utterly depraved, and then basically you create this structure, you break down the person, and then the only possible redemption is then offered through the structure of the religion itself. But you
this
know,
has
I
come up in some prison ministry situations where they've invaded prison ministries, and his terribly sexist hierarchy has come up.
I mean, I have an image in one of my articles taken out of a Bill Gothard manual in which there's like this chisel, God striking, what is it, the hand of the, held by the man, which is in striking the diamond to shape the woman. I forget exactly
how
it
Yeah, there's a bunch
works.
Of that stuff.
Well, it's also very, the discipleship thing is that you have to link up with a particular human master who disciples you in order to be into this system, which even when I was a fundamentalist, I thought, wait a minute, that kind of strikes of an intermediary rather than going straight to God.
Yeah, and it is like how countercultural cults work, right? It's also how these big mega churches often work. So they create that hierarchy. The idea is to take someone who's younger and more vulnerable, bring them in, and engage in a process that's called shepherding.
Yeah.
And if you look at cult research, you'll see that that is a common technique or strategy.
So what was the straw that broke the camel's back?
Well, so for me, I was a psychology intern here in Seattle, had finished the academic part of my PhD, and I was working in one of my rotations at Children's Hospital on what's called the consult liaison service. That means I was providing psychotherapy services and consulting to staff and families with children on the medical units. So I was seeing children who were struggling with leukemia and cancer and suffering unto death. Literally, I remember one two-year-old with a spinal cord tumor who was at that point paraplegic already, and even if they could save his life, would be remain paraplegic, but most likely was simply going to go through a horrendous process of treatment only to die of the cancer. And I listened to people around me trying to rationalize that or justify it in the context of their belief in an omnipotent, omnibenevolent, you know, loving interventionist God. And all of those justifications didn't make it just. They were self-soothing, but they were ultimately self-serving. There was nothing fair about the idea that, well, maybe this child is going to die, but it's going to, you know, it's going to make everyone else more compassionate. It's going to bring blessings into other people's lives. It's going to provide an opportunity to tell of God's love, blah, blah. You know, none of that is fair or just. And I finally got angry, I think, at the God in my head, and I said, I'm not making excuses for you anymore. I'm done. And I felt like at that point I had been, you know, holding my faith together with, as I like to say, duct tape and baling wire. And as soon as I stopped trying so hard, what I realized is that really all I had left was duct tape and baling wire.
Because those children are dying at the same random rate as anybody else, prayer or no prayer. If there's a loving God, then he's not a loving God. We're talking with Valerie Tirico, former fundamentalist evangelical Wheaton graduate, who has a book out called Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light. We'll continue our talk after the break. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is Free Thought Radio.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we are talking on the phone with Valerie Tirico and about her book, Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light. First, Valerie, how can someone find your book? Order it.
Well, the easiest would be just to go to Amazon or any other online retailer. The publisher is actually the Oracle Institute Press, but if you go online, you'll come across it.
Trusting Doubt, Valerie Tirico.
That reminds me of something Oscar Wilde said. We could paraphrase that. He said the best way to conquer temptation is to yield to it. Well, I think the best way to conquer doubt is to yield to it.
That's a great way to put it. You know, I mean, people, actually, I've heard the scientific method described as institutionalized structure doubt. You know, what I love about science that's so the opposite of the evangelicalism I grew up in is you're forced to ask the questions that could show you wrong, right? So instead of a confirmatory strategy where you selectively look for evidence that backs up what you already have decided is true, you say, here's what I think to be true. Now, what would show me wrong?
So we were talking during the break, Valerie, about what to finish up with the few minutes we have left, what's uppermost in your mind. And you thought you'd like to say something about the harm of religion to women, how women fare with religion. So let's talk about that for a few minutes.
Well, you know, during the election cycle back, you remember when there were a number of conservative candidates who had what was called rape Tourette's, like they just couldn't stop themselves from saying horrible things about women. I decided to write about that and to write about kind of the way that my hypothesis that they were saying horrible things about women because they were biblical literalists and went back into a corner that's what they honestly believed. And as I dug into the Bible, one of the things that I realized is this question of what God says in the Bible or what the Bible says about rape and rape babies is that there is no place in the Bible that it suggests that a woman's consent is required or even desired prior to sex. And there's lots of places in which God sanctions or blesses non-consensual sex. So until I started digging into it to write about it, I hadn't even realized the depth of the problem.
Women are property in the Bible.
Hey, and I can make a little commercial advertisement for my book on the Bible and women called Woe to the Women, the Bible Tells Me So, and I have chapters on each of those. But I remember being so appalled when I read the Bible as a college student about that subject of, well, sexual violence against women in the Bible.
Absolutely.
Women shocking.
Are given in marriage. They're sold as slaves with God's blessing. You know, the Israelites are given permission to take virgin sex slaves from as kind of the booty of war. Even in the New Testament, there is never any indication that a woman's consent is desired prior to sex.
Women submit to your husbands.
So what about what's going on right now in the United States, the reproductive war against women's rights?
Well, I think it goes back to what Dan was just talking about, that if you look at the Bible, it's an Iron Age code in which women are protected essentially as property, just like livestock and slaves and children, right? They are the property of men who then control their reproduction, and a good woman in essentially is like a good purebred dog or cow. You want to make sure that she's having offspring from the right sources, and so you work to control her fertility and her sexuality. And I think that at the deep root of it, all of these laws that have then become sanctified and had God's name put on them really are about this idea of, at the root, men wanting to make sure that they know the source of the progeny or the kind of children that they are investing in. But it's gotten so corrupted with layers of history and layers of sacred language on top of it and rules and then anti-contraceptive mandates, for example, from the Catholic Church, that and now they've managed to kind of take every single highly effective contraceptive and label it an abortifacient.
Even though that's not true.
Even though we know it's not true. I have a blog, awaypoint.wordpress.org, where I aggregate the articles that I write for places like Salon and the Huffington Post and Alternet. And I often write about women's issues and about contraceptive issues because without a woman being able to decide when and whether to have a child, a woman can't take care of her family. She can't fulfill her dreams. There's no point in having dreams if you never know when you're going to be pregnant.
Well, and speaking of your blogs, there was one that you wrote for that was on Salon.com, I guess, last year, where you have something very positive to project, which is that you're predicting that religion may not survive the internet. And I think we've only got a minute left or so. Can you summarize that argument?
Well, again, that article you can find at a waypoint. Religion is doing its best to kind of mutate and adapt and co-opt the internet. But the reality is that there's all kinds of information there that, you know, fundamentalism doesn't do well when people have free access to information and there's information there about the contradictions in scriptural, about the kind of moral bankruptcy of positions like anti-contraception, you know, when you know, we know it contributes to poverty and to harm and to maternal death. There's information about spiritual communities that are coming together, even non-theistic or explicitly atheistic spiritual communities, like the Atheist Church in London, that was put together by Pippa Evans and Sanderson Jones. So when people get onto the internet, and then the wonders of science and the way that the scientific method is revealing to us the incredible intricacy of our world and the beauty, it's so much richer and so much deeper than the stories in the Bible. I just think that in that context, it's going to be hard for thinking people to hold on to those archaic beliefs.
It's like the second law of thermodynamics. A closed system doesn't want information coming from the outside of it to disrupt that process. And fundamentalism is really a closed system. We're talking with, thank you, Valerie. Valerie Tirico, a psychologist, author of the book Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at All Beliefs in a New Light. Thank you, Dave McCann, for producing and engineering our show, which is produced here in Madison, Wisconsin. You can listen to the show as a podcast. Go to ffrf.org/news/radio for all you want to know about Free Thought Radio.
Go to our website at ffrf.org to look us up, to join us, to ask for a sample copy of our newspaper, Free Thought Today. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope not someday, but today, you will join us at ffrf.org. Help support our radio show, our 12 lawsuits, our growing staff, including 5 staff attorneys working to end violations. And tune in next week for more Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday